Josie could taste the heat of him like cinnamon candy, the kind that burned. Finally, when Josie remembered that she had to breathe, she tore away from Matt. She had never been so aware of every inch of her skin. Even the bits hidden under layers of t-shirt and sweater had come alive. "Jesus," Matt said, backing away. She panicked. Maybe he had just remembered he was kissing a girl who 5 minutes ago had been a social pariah. Or maybe she'd done something wrong during the kiss. It's not like there was a manual you could read so you'd know how to do it right.
"I guess I'm not very good at that," Josie stammered.
Matt raised his brows.
"If you get much better, you might kill me."
Josie felt a smile start inside her like a candle flame.
"Really?"
He nodded.
"That was my first kiss," she admitted.
When Matt touched her lower lip with his thumb, Josie could feel it everywhere, from her fingertips to her throat to the heat between her legs.
"Well," he said, "it's not going to be your last."
Alex was getting ready in her bathroom when Josie wandered in, looking for a new razor.
"What's that?"
Josie had asked, scrutinizing Alex's face in the mirror as if it belonged to a stranger.
"Mascara?"
"Well, I know what it is," Josie said. "I meant, what's it doing on you?"
"Maybe I felt like wearing makeup."
Josie sank down onto the lip of the bathtub, grinning.
"And maybe I'm the Queen of England. What is it? A new photo for some law review?"
Suddenly, her eyebrows shot up.
"You're not going on, like, a date, are you?"
"Not like a date," Alex said, brushing on blush. "It's an honest-to-goodness one."
"Oh my gosh. Tell me about him."
"I don't know anything. Liz set me up."
"Liz the custodian?"
"She's a groundskeeper," Alex said.
"Whatever. She must have told you something about this guy."
Josie hesitated.
"It is a guy, right?"
"Josie!"
"Well, it's been a really long time. The last date you went out on that I can remember was the man who wouldn't eat anything green."
"That wasn't the issue," Alex said. "It was that he wouldn't let me eat anything green." Josie stood up and reached for a tube of lipstick.
"This is a good color for you," she said, and she swept the tube over Alex's mouth.
Alex and Josie were exactly the same height. Looking into her daughter's eyes, Alex could see a tiny reflection of herself. She wondered why she'd never done this with Josie. Sat her down in the bathroom and played with eyeshadow, painted her toenails, curled her hair. They were memories that every other mother of a daughter seemed to have. Only now was Alex realizing that it had been up to her to create them.
"There,"
Josie said, turning Alex to look in the mirror.
"What do you think?"
Alex was staring, but not at herself. Over her shoulder was Josie. And for the first time, Alex could really see a piece of herself in her daughter. It wasn't so much the shape of the face, but the shine of it. Not the color of the eyes, but the dream caught like smoke in them. There was no amount of expensive makeup that would make her look the way her Josie did. That was simply what falling in love did to a person. Could you be jealous of your own child?
"Well," Josie said, patting Alex's shoulders, "I'd ask you out for a second date."
The doorbell rang.
"I'm not even dressed," Alex said, panicked. "I'll stall him."
Josie hurried down the stairs as Alex shimmied into a black dress and heels. She could hear conversation stir, rise up the stairs. Joe Urquhart was a Canadian banker who'd been roommates with Liz's cousin in Toronto. He was, she had promised, a nice guy. Alex asked why then, if he was so nice, he was still single. How would you answer that question? Liz had asked, and Alex had to think for a moment. I'm not that nice, she had said. She was pleasantly surprised to see that Joe was not troll-statured, that he had a head of wavy brown hair that didn't seem to be attached by double-sided tape, and that he had teeth. He whistled when he saw Alex. All rise, he said. And by all, I do mean Mr. Happy. The smile froze on Alex's face. Would you excuse me for a moment? She asked, and she dragged Josie into the kitchen. Shoot me now. Okay, that was pretty awful. But at least he eats green food. I asked. What if you go out there and say I'm violently ill? Alex said. You and I can get takeout, rent a movie or something. Josie's smile faded. But Mom, I've already got plans. She peered out the doorway to where Joe was waiting. I could tell Matt that... No, Alex said, forcing a smile. One of us ought to be having a good time. She walked out of the kitchen and found Joe holding up a candlestick, scrutinizing the bottom. I'm very sorry, but something's come up. Tell me about it, babe, Joe said, leering. No, I mean that I can't go out tonight. There's a case, she lied. I have to go back into court. Maybe being from Canada was what kept Joe from understanding how incredibly unlikely it would be for court to be in session on a Saturday night. Oh, he said. Well, far be it for me to keep those wheels of justice from grinding. Some other time? Alex nodded, ushering him outside. She took off her heels and padded upstairs to change into her rattiest sweats. She would eat chocolate for dinner. She would watch chick flicks until she was completely sobbed out. As she passed the bathroom, she could hear the shower running, Josie getting ready for her own date. For a moment, Alex stood with her hand on the door, wondering whether Josie would welcome her if she went in and guided her in putting on her makeup, offered to style her hair, just as Josie had done for her. But for Josie, that was natural. She'd spent a lifetime grabbing moments of Alex's time when Alex was busy preparing for something else. Somehow, Alex had assumed that time was infinite, that Josie would always be there waiting. She never guessed that she herself would one day be left behind. In the end, Alex drew away from the bathroom door without knocking. Too afraid she might hear Josie say she didn't need her mother's help to even risk making that initial offer. The one thing that had saved Josie from total social ruin in the wake of Peter's math presentation was her simultaneous anointing as Matt Royston's girlfriend. Unlike most of the other sophomores who were occasional couples, random hookups at parties, best friend with benefits situations, she and Matt were an item. Matt walked her to her classes and often left her at the door with a kiss that everyone watched. Anyone stupid enough to mention Peter Houghton's name in conjunction with Josie's had to answer to him. Everyone, that is, except for Peter himself. At work, he didn't seem to be able to pick up on the clues that Josie gave him. Turning her back when he came into the room, ignoring him when he asked her a question. He finally cornered her in the supply room one afternoon. How come you're acting like this? He said. Because when I was nice to you, you thought we were friends. But we are friends, he replied. Josie had faced him. You don't get to decide that, she said. One afternoon at work, when Josie went out to the dumpster with a load of trash, Peter was already there. It was his 15-minute break. Usually he walked across the street and bought himself an apple juice, but today he was leaning over the metal lip of the dumpster. Move, she said, and she hefted the bags of garbage up and over. As soon as they struck bottom, A shower of sparks rose. Almost immediately, fire climbed up the cardboard stacked inside the dumpster. It roared against the metal.
Peter, get down from there,
Josie yelled. Peter didn't move. The flames danced in front of his face. The heat distorted his features.
Peter, now!
She reached up, grabbing his arm, pulling him down to the pavement as something, toner, oil, exploded inside the dumpster.
We have to call 911,
Josie cried, and she scrambled to her feet. The firemen arrived in minutes, spraying some noxious chemical into the dumpster. Josie paged Mr. Cargrew, who'd been on the golf course.
Thank God you weren't hurt, he said to both of them. Josie saved me, Peter replied.
While Mr. Cargrew spoke to the firemen, she went back into the copy shop with Peter following.
I knew you'd save me, Peter said. That's why I did it.
Did what? But Peter didn't have to answer, because Josie already knew why Peter had been up on the dumpster when he should have been on break. She knew who'd tossed the match the moment he heard her exiting the back door with bags of garbage. Josie told herself, even as she pulled Mr. Cargrew aside, that she was only doing what any responsible employee would do, tell the boss who had tried to destroy his property. She didn't admit that she was scared by what Peter had said, by the truth of it. And she pretended not to feel that small fanning in her chest, a smaller version of the fire that Peter had started, which she identified, for the very first time in her life, as revenge. When Mr. Cargrew fired Peter, Josie didn't listen to the conversation. She felt his gaze on her, hot, accusing, as he left, but she focused her attention on a job from a local bank instead. As she stared at the papers coming out of the machine, she considered how strange it was to measure success by how closely each product resembled the one that had come before. After school, Josie waited for Matt at the flagpole. He'd sneak up behind her and she'd pretend she didn't notice him coming until he kissed her. People watched, and Josie loved that. In a way, she thought of her status as a secret identity. Now, if she got straight A's or said she actually liked to read for fun, she wouldn't be thought of as a freak, simply because when people saw her, they noticed her popularity first. It was, she figured, a little like what her mother experienced wherever she went. When you were the judge, no other trait really mattered. Sometimes she had nightmares in which Matt realized she was a fraud, that she wasn't beautiful. She wasn't cool. She wasn't anyone worthy of admiration. What were we thinking? She imagined her friends saying. And maybe for that reason, it was so hard even when she was awake to think of them as friends. She and Matt had plans for this weekend, important plans that she could hardly keep to herself. As she sat on the stone steps leading up to the flagpole, waiting for him, she felt someone tap her on the shoulder. You're late, she accused, grinning, and then she turned around to see Peter. He looked just as shocked as she felt, even though he'd been the one to seek her out. In the months since Josie had gotten Peter fired from the copy shop, she had gone out of her way to avoid coming in contact with him. No easy feat, given that they were in math class together every day and passed in the halls numerous times. Josie would always make sure she had her nose in a book or her attention firmly focused on another conversation.
Josie, he said, can we talk for a minute?
Students were streaming out of the school. She could feel their glances flick over her like a whip. Were they staring at her because of who she was, or because of who she was with?
No,
she said flatly.
It's just, I really need Mr. Cargrew to give me my job back. I know it was a mistake, what I did. I thought maybe, Maybe if you told him...
He broke off.
He likes you, Peter said.
Josie wanted to tell him to go away, that she didn't want to work with him again, much less be seen having a conversation with him. But something had happened during the months since Peter had set that dumpster fire. The payback she'd thought he was due, after his math class elegy to Josie, had burned in her chest every time she thought about it. And Josie had started to wonder if maybe Peter had gotten the wrong idea, not because he was crazy, but because she'd led him to it. After all, when no one was around at the copy shop, they'd talked to each other. They'd laughed. He was an okay kid, just not someone you wanted to be associated with, necessarily, in public. But feeling that way was different than acting on it, right? She wasn't like Drew and Matt and John, who'd shove Peter into the wall when they walked by him in the halls, or who stole his brown bag lunch and played monkey in the middle with it until it ripped and the contents spilled onto the floor. Was she? She didn't want to talk to Mr. Cargrew. She didn't want Peter to think that she wanted to be his friend, that she even wanted to be his acquaintance. But she didn't want to be like Matt either, whose comments to Peter sometimes made her feel sick inside. Peter was sitting across from her, waiting for an answer, and then suddenly he wasn't. He tumbled down the stone steps as Matt stood over him.
"Get away from my girlfriend, homo," Matt said. "Go find a nice little boy to play with."
Peter had landed face down on the pavement. When he lifted his head, his lip was bleeding. He looked at Josie first, and to her surprise, he didn't seem upset or even angry. Just truly, deeply tired.
"Matt," Peter said, coming up on his knees, "do you have a big dick?"
"Wouldn't you like to know?" Matt said.
"Not really."
Peter staggered to his feet.
"I just wondered if it was long enough for you to go fuck yourself."
Josie felt the air charge between them the moment before Matt was on Peter like a hurricane, punching him in the face, wrestling him bodily to the ground.
"You like this, don't you?"
Matt spat as he pinned Peter down. Peter shook his head, tears streaming down his cheeks, streaking the blood.
"Get off!"
"I bet you wish you could," Matt sneered.
By now, a crowd had gathered. Josie glanced around frantically, looking for a teacher, but it was after school and there were none around.
"Stop!"
she cried, watching Peter squirm away as Matt went after him again.
"Matt, just stop it!"
He pulled his next punch and got to his feet, leaving Peter curled on his side like a fiddlehead.
"You're right. Why waste my time?" Matt said,
and he started walking, waiting for Josie to fall into place beside him. They were heading toward his car. Josie knew that they'd swing into town and grab a coffee before going back to her house. There, Josie would focus on her homework until it became impossible to ignore Matt rubbing her shoulders or kissing her neck, and then they'd make out until they heard her mother's car pulling into the garage. There was still an unleashed fury to Matt. His fists were curled at his sides. Josie reached for one, unfurled his hand, threaded their fingers together.
"Can I say something without making you mad?" she asked.
This was rhetorical, Josie knew. Matt was already angry. It was the flip side to the passion that made her feel as if she'd gone electric inside, just directed negatively at someone weak. When he didn't answer, Josie forged ahead.
"I don't get why you have to pick on Peter Houghton."
"The homo was the one who started it," Matt argued. "You heard what he said."
"Well, yeah," Josie said, "after you pushed him down the steps."
Matt stopped walking.
"Since when did you become his guardian angel?"
He was staring in a way that cut her to the quick. Josie shivered. I'm not, she said quickly, and she took a deep breath. I don't like the way you treat kids who aren't like us, all right? Just because you don't want to hang out with losers doesn't mean you have to torture them, does it?
Yeah, it does, Matt said. Because if there isn't a them, there can't be an us.
His eyes narrowed.
You should know that better than anyone.
Josie felt herself go numb. She didn't know whether Matt was bringing up Peter's little math chart, or worse, her history as Peter's friend in earlier grades. But she didn't want to find out, either. This was her biggest fear, after all, that the in-crowd would realize she'd been out all the time. She wouldn't tell Mr. Cargrew what Peter had said. She wouldn't even acknowledge him again, if he came up to her. And she wouldn't lie to herself either, and pretend she was any less awful than Matt when he mocked Peter or beat him up. You did what you had to cement your place in the pecking order. And the best way to stay on top was to step on someone else to get there.
So, Matt said, are you coming with me?
She wondered if Peter was still crying, if his nose was broken, if that was the worst of it.
Yes, Josie said, and she followed Matt without looking back.
Lincoln, Massachusetts was a suburb of Boston that had once been farmland and that now was a hodgepodge of massive homes with ridiculously high real estate values. Josie stared out the window at the scenery that might have been hers to grow up with, under different circumstances. The stone walls that snaked around properties, the historic property badges worn by houses that were nearly 200 years old, the small ice cream stand that smelled like fresh milk. She wondered whether Logan Rourke would suggest that they take a ride down to the Dairy Joy and share a sundae. Maybe he would walk right up to the counter and order butter pecan without even having to ask her what her favorite flavor was. Maybe that's what a father could spin out of instinct. Matt was driving lazily, his wrist canted over the steering wheel. Just 16, he had his driver's license, and was ready and willing to go anywhere, to get a quart of milk for his mother, to drop off the dry cleaning, to squire Josie home after school. For him, it wasn't the destination that was important, it was the journey, which was why Josie had asked him to take her to see her father. Besides, it wasn't as if she had an alternative. She couldn't very well ask her mother to do it, given that her mother didn't even know Josie had been looking for Logan Rourke. She could have probably figured out how to take a bus to Boston, but reaching a home in the suburbs was more complicated than that. So in the end, she decided to tell Matt the whole truth, that she had never known her father, and that she'd found him in a newspaper, because he was running for public office. Logan Rourke's driveway wasn't as grandiose as some of the others they'd passed, but it was immaculate. The lawn had been trimmed to a half inch, a spray of wildflowers craned their necks around the iron base of the mailbox. Hanging from a tree branch overhead was the house number, 59. Josie felt the hair stand up on the back of her neck. When she'd been on the field hockey team last year, that had been her jersey number. It was a sign. Matt pulled into the driveway. There were two cars, a Lexus and a Jeep, and also a toddler's ride-on fire truck. Josie couldn't take her eyes off it. Somehow, she hadn't imagined that Logan Rourke might have other children.
You want me to come in with you? Matt asked.
Josie shook her head.
I'm okay.
As she walked up to the front door, she began to wonder what on earth she'd been thinking. You couldn't just drop in on some guy who was a public figure, could you? Surely there would be a Secret Service agent or something, an attack dog. As if she'd cued it, a bark rang out. Josie turned in the direction of the sound to find a tiny little Yorkie with a pink bow on its head making a beeline for her feet. The front door opened.
Titania, leave the postman alone.
Logan Rourke broke off when he noticed Josie standing in front of him.
You're not the postman.
He was taller than she'd imagined, and he looked just like he did in the globe. White hair, Roman nose, rangy build. But his eyes were the same color as hers, so electric that Josie couldn't look away. She wondered if this had been her mother's downfall, too.
You're Alex's daughter, he said.
Well, Josie replied,
and yours.
Through the open doorway, Josie heard the shriek of a child still dizzy and delighted from being chased. A woman's voice.
Logan, who is it?
He reached back and closed the door so that Josie couldn't see into his life anymore. He looked incredibly uncomfortable, although in all fairness, Josie imagined it was a little off-putting to be confronted by the daughter you'd abandoned before birth.
What are you doing here? Wasn't that obvious?
I wanted to meet you. I thought you might want to meet me.
He drew a deep breath.
This really isn't a good time.
Josie glanced back at the driveway, where Matt was still parked.
I can wait.
Look, it's just that
I'm running for political office. Right now, this is a complication I can't afford. Josie tripped over that one word. She was a complication? She watched Logan Rourke take out his wallet and peel $300 bills away from the rest.
Here,
he said, pushing it into her hand.
Will this do it?
Josie tried to breathe, but someone had driven a stake through her chest. She realized that this was blood money, that her own father thought she'd come here to blackmail him.
After the election, he said, maybe we could have lunch.
The bills were crisp in her palm, the kind that had just come into circulation. Josie had a sudden memory of being little and accompanying her mother to the bank, how her mother would let her count the 20s to make sure the teller had gotten the withdrawal amount right, how fresh money always smelled of ink and good fortune. Logan Rourke wasn't her father, not any more than the guy who'd taken their coins at the toll booth or any other stranger. You could share DNA with someone and still have nothing in common with them. Josie realized, fleetingly, that she had already learned that lesson from her mother.
Well,
Logan Rourke said, and he started toward the door again. He hesitated with his hand on the knob.
I don't know your name.
Josie swallowed.
Margaret,
she said, so that she would be just as much of a lie to him as he was to her.
Margaret, then,
he answered, and he slipped back inside. On the way to the car, Josie opened her fingers like a flower. She watched the bills fall to the ground near a plant that looked, like everything else here, as if it was thriving. Honestly, the whole idea for the game came to Peter when he was asleep. He'd created computer games before, Pong replicates, racing courses, and even one sci-fi scenario that let you play online with someone in another country if they logged on to the site. But this was the biggest idea he'd conceived of yet. It came about because, after one of Joey's football games, they'd stopped off at a pizza place, where Peter had eaten way too much meatball and sausage pizza and had been staring at an arcade game called Deer Hunt. You put in your quarter and shot your fake rifle at the bucks that poked their heads out from behind trees. If you hit a doe, you lost. That night, Peter dreamed about hunting with his father, but instead of going after deer, they were looking for real people. He had awakened in a sweat, his hand cramped as if he'd been holding a gun. It wouldn't be all that hard to create avatars, computerized personas. He'd done some experimenting, and even if the skin tone wasn't right and the graphics weren't perfect, he knew how to differentiate between races and hair color and build through programming language. It might be kind of cool to do a game where the prey was human. But war games were old hat, and even gangs had been totally overdone, thanks to Grand Theft Auto. What he needed, Peter realized, was a new villain, one that other people would want to gun down too. That was the joy of a video game, watching someone who deserved it getting his comeuppance. He tried to think of other microcosms of the universe that might be battlegrounds, alien invasions, Wild West shootouts, spy missions. Then Peter thought about the front line he braved every day. What if you took the prey and made them the hunters? Peter got out of bed and sat down at his desk, pulling his eighth-grade yearbook from the drawer where he'd banished it months ago. He'd create a computer game that was Revenge of the Nerds, but updated for the 21st century. A fantasy world where the balance of power was turned on its head, where the underdog finally got a chance to beat the bullies. He took a marker and started to look through the yearbook, circling portraits. Drew Gerard, Matt Royston, John Eberhard. Peter turned the page and stopped for a moment. Then he circled Josie Cormier's face, too. "Can you stop here?" Josie said, when she really didn't think she was going to be able to spend another minute riding in the car and pretending that her meeting with her father had gone well. Matt had barely pulled over when she opened the door, flew through the high grass into the woods at the edge of the road. She sank down on the carpet of pine needles and started to cry. What she'd been expecting, she really couldn't say, except that this wasn't it. Unconditional acceptance, maybe? Curiosity, at the very least.
"Josie," Matt said, coming up behind her. "You okay?"
She tried to say yes, but she was so sick of lying. She felt Matt's hand stroke her hair, and that only made her cry harder. Tenderness cut as sharp as any knife.
"He didn't give a shit about me."
"Then you shouldn't give a shit about him," Matt answered.
Josie glanced up at him.
"It's not that simple."
He pulled her into his arms.
"Aw, Joe."
Matt was the only one who'd ever given her a nickname. She couldn't remember her mother calling her anything silly, like Pumpkin or Ladybug, the way other parents did. When Matt called her Joe, it reminded her of Little Women, and although she was pretty sure Matt had never read the Alcott novel, secretly, she was pleased to be associated with a character so strong and sure of herself.
"It's stupid. I don't even know why I'm crying. I wanted him to like me."
"I'm crazy about you," Matt said. "Does that count?"
He leaned forward and kissed her, right on the trail of her tears.
"It counts a lot."
She felt Matt's lips move from her cheek to her neck to the spot behind her ear that always made her feel like she was dissolving. She was a novice at fooling around, but Matt had coaxed her further and further each time they were alone.
"It's your fault," he'd say, and give her that smile. "If you weren't this hot, I'd be able to keep my hands off you."
That alone was an aphrodisiac to Josie. Her? Hot? And, just as Matt had promised every time, it did feel good to let him touch her everywhere, to let him taste her. Every incremental intimacy with Matt felt as if she were falling off a cliff, that loss of breath, those butterflies in her stomach. One step, and she'd be flying. It didn't occur to Josie, when she leaped, that she was just as likely to fall. Now she felt his hands moving under her t-shirt, slipping beneath the lace of her bra. Her legs tangled with his, he rubbed up against her. When Matt tugged up her shirt so that the cool air feathered over her skin, she snapped back to reality.
"We can't do this," she whispered.
Matt's teeth scraped over her shoulder.
"We're parked on the side of the road."
He looked up at her, drugged, feverish.
"But I want you,"
Matt said, like he had a dozen times. This time, though, she glanced up.
I want you.
Josie could have stopped him, but she realized she didn't intend to. He wanted her, and right now, that was what she most needed to hear. There was a moment when Matt went still, wondering if the fact that she hadn't shoved his hands away meant what he thought it meant. She heard the rip of a foil condom packet. How long had he been carrying that around? Then he tore at his jeans and hiked up her skirt, as if he still expected her to change her mind. Josie felt Matt pulling aside the elastic of her underwear, the burn of his finger pushing inside her. This was nothing like the times before, when his touch had left a track like a comet over her skin. When she found herself aching after she told him she wanted to stop. Matt shifted his weight and came down on top of her again, only this time there was more burning, more pressure.
Ow,
she whimpered, and Matt hesitated.
I don't want to hurt you, he said.
She turned her head away.
Just do it,
Josie said, and Matt pushed his hips flush against hers. It was the kind of pain that, even though she was expecting it, made her cry out. Matt mistook that for passion.
I know, baby,
he groaned. She could feel his heartbeat, but from the inside, and then he started to move faster, bucking against her like a fish released from a hook onto a dock. Josie wanted to ask Matt whether it had hurt the first time he had done it, too. She wondered if it always would hurt. Maybe pain was the price everyone paid for love. She turned her face into Matt's shoulder and tried to understand why, even with him still inside of her, she felt empty.
Peter, Mrs. Sandringham said at the end of English class, could I see you for a moment?
At the sound of his teacher's summons, Peter sank down in his chair. He began to think of excuses he could give his parents when he came home with another failing grade. He actually liked Mrs. Sandringham. She was only in her late 20s. You could actually look at her while she was prattling on about grammar and Shakespeare and imagine not so long ago when she might have been slouched in a seat like any ordinary kid and wondering why the clock never seemed to move. Peter waited until the rest of the class had cleared out before he approached the teacher's desk.
I just wanted to talk to you about your essay, Mrs. Sandringham said. I haven't graded everyone's yet, but I did have a chance to look over yours, and...
I can redo it, Peter blurted out. Mrs. Sandringham raised her brows.
But, Peter, I wanted to tell you that you're getting an A.
She handed it to him. Peter stared at the bright red grade in the margin. The assignment had been to write about a significant event that had changed your life. Although it had happened only a week ago, Peter had written about getting fired for setting the fire in the dumpster at work. In it, he didn't mention Josie Cormier at all. Mrs. Sandringham had circled one sentence in his conclusion.
I've learned you will get caught, so you have to think things through before you act.
The teacher reached out and put her hand on Peter's wrist.
You really have learned something from this incident, she said, and she smiled at him. I'd trust you in a heartbeat.
Peter nodded and took the paper from the desk. He swam into the stream of students in the hallway, still holding it. He imagined what his mother would say if he came home with a paper that had a big fat A on it, if, for just once in his life, he did something everyone expected of Joey and not Peter. But that would have necessitated telling his mother about the dumpster incident in the first place, or admitting that he'd been fired at all, and now spent his after-school hours at the library instead of at the copy center. Peter crumpled up the essay and threw it into the first trash can that he passed. As soon as Josie started spending her free time almost exclusively with Matt, Maddie Shaw had seamlessly slipped into the position of being Courtney's sidekick. In a way, She fit better than Josie ever had. If you were walking behind Courtney and Maddie, you wouldn't be able to tell who was who. Maddie had so closely cultivated the style and movement of Courtney that she'd elevated it from imitation to art. Tonight they'd gathered at Maddie's house because her parents had gone to visit her older brother, a sophomore at Syracuse. They weren't drinking. It was hockey season, and the players had to sign a contract with the coach. But Drew Gerard had rented the uncut version of a teen sex comedy, and the guys were discussing who was hotter, Elisha Cuthbert or Shannon Elizabeth.
"I wouldn't throw either of them out of bed," Drew said. "What makes you think they'd get in the first place?"
John Eberhard laughed.
"My reputation reaches far and wide."
Courtney smirked. "It's the only part of you that does."
"Aw, Court, you wish you knew that for sure."
"Or not."
Josie was sitting on the floor with Maddie, trying to make a Ouija board work. They'd found it in the basement closet, along with chutes and ladders and Trivial Pursuit. Josie's fingertips rested lightly on the planchette.
"Are you pushing it?"
"Swear to God, no," Maddie said.
"Are you?"
Josie shook her head. She wondered what kind of ghost would come to hang out at a teenage party. Someone who had died tragically, of course, and too young. In a car crash, maybe.
"What's your name?"
Josie said loudly. The planchette swiveled to the letter A, and then B, and then stopped.
"Abe,"
Maddie announced.
"It must be."
"Or Abby."
"Are you a male or female?"
Maddie asked. The planchette slipped off the edge of the board entirely. Drew started to laugh.
"Maybe it's gay." "Takes one to know one," John said.
Matt yawned and stretched, his shirt riding up. Although Josie's back was to him, she could practically sense this, so attuned were their bodies.
"As thrillingly fun as this has been, we're out of here. Joe, come on."
Josie watched the planchette spell out a word. N-O.
"I'm not leaving," she said. "I'm having fun."
"Meow," Drew said. "Who's pussy whipped?"
Since they'd started dating, Matt spent more time with Josie than with his friends. And although Matt had told her he'd much rather fool around with her than be in the company of fools, Josie knew it was still important to him to have the respect of Drew and John. But that didn't mean he had to treat her like a slave, did it?
"I said we're leaving," Matt repeated.
Josie glanced up at him.
"And I said I'll come when I want to come."
Matt smiled at his friends, smug.
"You never came in your life before you met me," he said.
Drew and John burst out laughing, and Josie felt herself flush with embarrassment. She stood, averting her eyes, and ran up the basement stairs. In the entryway of Maddie's house, she grabbed her jacket. When she heard footsteps behind her, Josie didn't even turn around.
"I was having fun, so..."
She broke off with a small cry as Matt grabbed her arm hard and spun her around, pinning her up against the wall by her shoulders.
"You're hurting me."
"Don't ever do that to me again."
"You're the one who..."
"You made me look like an idiot," Matt said. "I told you it was time to go."
Bruises bloomed on her skin where he held her fast, as if she were a canvas and he was determined to leave his mark. She went limp beneath his hands. Instinct. A surrender.
I'm sorry,
she whispered. The words were a key. Matt's grip relaxed.
"Joe,"
he sighed, and he rested his forehead against hers.
"I don't like sharing you. You can't blame me for that."
Josie shook her head, but she still didn't trust herself to speak.
"It's just that I love you so much."
She blinked.
"You do?"
He hadn't said those words yet, and she hadn't said them either, even though she felt them. because if he didn't say them back, then Josie was sure she'd simply evaporate on the spot from sheer humiliation. But here was Matt, saying he loved her, first.
"Isn't that obvious?" he said,
and he took her hand, brought it to his lips, and kissed the knuckles so gently that Josie almost forgot all that had happened to get them to that moment.
"Kentucky Fried People,"
Peter said, mulling Derek's idea while they sat on the sidelines in gym class as the teams for basketball were being picked.
"I don't know. Doesn't it seem a little..."
"Graphic?" Derek said. "Since when were you aiming for politically correct? See, imagine if you could go to the art room, if you had enough points, and use the kiln as a weapon." Derek had been road-testing Peter's new computer game, pointing out room for improvement and flaws in the design. They knew they had plenty of time for conversation, since they were bound to be the last kids chosen for teams. Coach Spears had chosen Drew Gerard and Matt Royston to be team captains. A huge surprise. Not. They were varsity athletes, even as sophomores.
"Look alive, people," Coach called out. "You want your captains to think you're hungry to play. You want them to think you're the next Michael Jordan."
Drew pointed to a boy in the back.
"Noah."
Matt nodded to the kid who'd been sitting next to him.
"Charlie."
Peter turned to Derek.
"I heard that even though Michael Jordan's retired, he's still getting $40 million in endorsements."
"That means he makes $109,589 a day for not working," Derek figured.
"Ash," Drew called out.
"Robbie,"
Matt said. Peter leaned closer to Derek. "If he goes to see a movie, it'll cost him $10, but he'll make $9,132 while he's there." Derek grinned. "If he hard-boils an egg for 5 minutes, he'll make $380.
"Stew."
"Freddy."
"Oh, boy."
"Walt."
By now, there were only three kids left to be picked for teams. Derek, Peter, and Royce, who had aggression issues and came complete with his own aide.
"Royce," Matt said.
"He makes $4,560.85 more than he would working at McDonald's," Derek added. Drew scrutinized Peter and Derek.
"He makes $2,283 watching a rerun of Friends," Peter said.
"If he wanted to save up for a new Maserati, it would take him a whole 21 hours," Derek said.
"Damn, I wish I could play basketball."
"Derek," Drew picked. Derek started to stand up.
"Yeah," Peter said, "but even if Michael Jordan saved 100% of his income for the next 450 years, he still wouldn't have as much as Bill Gates has right this second."
"All right," Matt said. "I'll take the homo."
Peter shuffled toward the back of Matt's team.
"You ought to be good at this game, Peter," Matt said, loud enough so that everyone else could hear. "Just keep your hands on the balls."
Peter leaned against a floor mat that had been strung on the wall, like the inside of an insane asylum, a rubber room where all hell could break loose. He sort of wished he was as sure of who he was as everyone else seemed to be.
"All right," Coach Spears said. "Let's play."
The first ice storm of the season arrived before Thanksgiving. It started after midnight, wind rattling the old bones of the house and pellets drumming the windows. The power went out, but Alex had been expecting that. She woke up with a start at the absolute silence that came with a loss of technology and reached for the flashlight that she'd put next to her bed. There were candles, too. Alex lit two candles and watched her shadow, larger than life, creep along the wall. She could remember nights like this when Josie was little, when they'd crawl into bed together and Josie would fall asleep crossing her fingers that there wouldn't be school in the morning.
How come grown-ups never got that kind of holiday? Even if there wasn't school tomorrow, which there wouldn't be, if Alex was guessing correctly, even if the wind was still howling as if the earth were in pain and the ice was caked on her windshield wipers, Alex would be expected to show up in court. Yoga classes and basketball games and theater performances would be postponed, but no one ever canceled real life. The door to the bedroom flew open. Josie stood there in a wife-beater tank and a pair of boys' boxers. Alex had no idea where she'd gotten them, and prayed they didn't belong to Matt Royston. For a moment, Alex could barely reconcile this young woman with her curves and long hair with the daughter she still expected, a little girl with an unraveling braid wearing Wonder Woman pajamas. She tossed back the covers on one side of the bed, an invitation. Josie dove underneath them, yanking the blankets up to her chin.
"It's freaky out there," she said. "It's like the sky's falling down."
"I'd be more worried about the roads. Do you think we'll have a snow day tomorrow?" Alex smiled in the dark. Josie may have been older, but her priorities were still the same.
"Most likely."
With a contented sigh, Josie flopped down on her pillow.
"I wonder if Matt and I could go skiing somewhere."
"You're not leaving this house if the roads are bad."
"You will. I don't have a choice," Alex said.
Josie turned to her, her eyes reflecting the candlelight.
"Everyone has a choice," she said.
She came up on an elbow.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Sure."
"Why didn't you marry Logan Rourke?"
Alex felt as if she'd been thrust out into the storm, naked. She was that unprepared for Josie's question.
"Where did this come from? What was it about him that wasn't good enough? You told me he was handsome and smart, and you had to love him, at least at one point."
"Josie, this is ancient history, and it's stuff you shouldn't worry about, because it has nothing to do with you."
"It has everything to do with me," Josie said. "I'm half him."
Alex stared up at the ceiling. Maybe the sky was falling down. Maybe that's what happened when you thought your smoke and mirrors would create a lasting illusion.
"He was all of those things," Alex said quietly. "It wasn't him at all. It was me."
"And then there was the whole married part." She sat up in bed.
"How did you find out?"
"It's all over the papers now that he's running for office. You don't have to be a rocket scientist."
"Did you call him?"
Josie looked her in the eye.
"No."
There was a part of Alex that wished Josie had talked to him, to see whether he'd followed Alex's career, if he'd even asked about her. The act of leaving Logan, which had seemed so righteous on behalf of her unborn baby, now seemed selfish. Why hadn't she talked to Josie about this before?
Because she'd been protecting Logan.
Josie may have grown up without knowing her father, but wasn't that better than learning he'd wanted you to be aborted?
One more lie, Alex thought. Just a little one. Just to keep Josie from being hurt. He wouldn't leave his wife.
Alex glanced sideways at Josie.
I couldn't make myself small enough to fit into the space he wanted me to fit into, in order to be part of his life. Does that make sense?
I guess. Beneath the covers, Alex reached for Josie's hand. It was the kind of action that would have seemed forced had it been in visible sight. Something too openly emotional for either of them to lay claim to. But here, in the dark, with the world tunneling in around them, it seemed perfectly natural.
I'm sorry, she said.
For what?
For not giving you the choice of having him around when you were growing up.
Josie shrugged and pulled her hand away.
You did the right thing.
I don't know, Alex sighed. The right thing sets you up to be incredibly lonely sometimes. Suddenly she turned to Josie, stretching a bright smile on her face. Why are we even talking about this? Unlike me, you're lucky in love, right? Just then, the power came back on. Downstairs, the microwave beeped to be reset. The light in the bathroom spilled yellow down the hallway.
I guess I'll go back to my own bed, Josie said.
Oh, all right, Alex answered, when what she meant to say was that Josie was welcome to stay right where she was. As Josie padded down the hallway, Alex reached over to reset her alarm clock. It blinked 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock in panicked LED, like Cinderella's red flag reminder that fairy tale endings are hard to come by. To Peter's surprise, the bouncer at the front runner didn't even glance at his fake ID, so before he had time to think twice about the fact that he was actually, finally, here, he was pushed inside. He was hit in the face with a blast of smoke, and it took him a minute to adjust to the dim light. Music filled in all the spaces between people, techno dance stuff that was so loud it made Peter's eardrums pulse. Two tall women were flanking the front door, checking out the new entrance. It took Peter a second glance to realize that one had the shadow of a beard on her face. His face. The other one looked more like a girl than most girls he'd ever seen, but then again, Peter had never seen a transvestite up close. Maybe they were perfectionists. Men were standing in groups of two or three, except for the ones that perched like hawks on a balcony overlooking the dance floor. There were men in leather chaps, men kissing other men in the corners, men passing joints. Mirrors on every wall made the club look huge, its rooms endless. It hadn't been hard to find out about the front runner, thanks to internet chat rooms. Since Peter was still taking driver's ed, he had to take a bus to Manchester and then a taxi to the club's front door. He still wasn't sure why he was there. It was like an anthropology experiment in his mind. See if he fit in with this society instead of his own. It wasn't that he wanted to fool around with a guy. Not yet, anyway. He just wanted to know what it was like to be among guys who were gay and totally okay with it. He wanted to know if they could look at him and know, instantly, that Peter belonged. He stopped in front of a couple that was going at it in a dark corner. Seeing a guy kiss a guy was strange in real life. Sure, there were gay kisses on television shows, big moments that usually were controversial enough to get press, so that Peter knew when they were airing, and he'd sometimes watch them to see if he felt anything watching them. But they were acted, just like regular hookups on TV shows, unlike the display in front of his eyes right now. He waited to see if his heart started pounding a little harder, if it made sense to him. He didn't feel particularly excited, though. Curious, sure. Did a beard scratch you when you were making out? And not repulsed. But Peter couldn't say he felt with any great conviction that that was something he wanted to try, too. The men broke away from each other, and one of them narrowed his eyes. "This ain't no peep show," he said, and he shoved Peter away. Peter stumbled, falling against someone sitting at the bar. "Whoa," the man said, and then his eyes lit up. "What have we here?"
"Sorry." "Don't be."
He was in his early 20s, with white blonde crew-cut hair and nicotine stains on his fingertips.
"First time here?"
Peter turned to him.
"How can you tell?"
"You've got that deer-in-the-headlights look." He stubbed out his cigarette and summoned the bartender, who, Peter noticed, looked like he'd walked out of the pages of a magazine.
"Rico, get my young friend here a drink. What would you like?"
Peter swallowed.
"Pepsi?"
The man's teeth flashed.
"Yeah, right.
I don't drink."
"He said. Here, then."
He handed a pair of small tubes to Peter, and then took two for himself out of his pocket. There was no powder in them, just air. Peter watched him open the top, inhale deeply, then do the same with the second vial in his other nostril.